Hello. Today in the Loopcast, I have Emmy, and we are discussing what narrative design teaches us about extremism. So this might sound kind of weird, and it is. It's intended to be weird. This is kind of one of our more experimental shows. And the reason I wanted to do it is that I admittedly have been listening to a lot of game design podcasts. YouTubes, presentations, whatever kind of I can just play in the background. And I started thinking, when we start conceptualizing extremism now, online extremism, do the same rules and dynamics of narrative design and games, creepypastas, whatever, do they apply to how people take up extremist narratives? So I don't know the answer. I haven't done any reading other than the YouTubes. So Emmy and I today are just going to kind of explore around and see if we can come up with a good idea or maybe a bad idea. Who knows? With that, please welcome Emmy. How's it going?
It's going good. I'm really excited that you sent me a bunch of prompts that are like related to kind of my individual type of brainworms, and we're like, all right, we're gonna put you on a podcast and have you just go nuts, because like, what else am I good for if not this exact conversation?
Well, I'm glad that this is your bucket of brainworms. Bucket
for sure. Or bucket coffee. I think it can be a bucket. Actually, you know what, I will own that. I do think the amount of brainworms I have could fit in a bucket. I think that is Not inaccurate.
So I would maybe start off with kind of a really basic question, and it's really broad, but how do we understand the internet, the online, as a platform for telling stories? So, you know, it could be just as simple as a creepypasta. It could be as complicated as a political narrative. But, you know, fundamentally, when we look at the internet and online, how do we understand it as a platform for telling stories?
I mean, that's all it is, right? Like, that's any communications platform. It's a platform for telling stories and record keeping. Like, the earliest forms of written language are record keeping and storytelling. You put a group of humans in a room together and they're going to want to fucking tell a story. And then they're going to post a photo of it on Instagram so everybody knows it happened. Like, that is how humans are oriented. From the first time some jackass put their mud covered hand on the cave wall or started trying to like carve shit into rocks, it was for the chance to like add their story to the human record. And the internet is like really special though, because now we have that same human instinct that makes us just a drive to tell a story, but with no geographic barriers. Like, those are fully removed. We have all the spatial barriers removed, and it's going to be a long time before people run out of internet to write on. And like even longer before people run out of things to say, which gives rise to like some really incredible and deeply creative communities that like can tell stories at light speed. Just amazing. Like, I don't know. So really recently there was r/place, which was the Reddit, like they're like April Fool's gag, which is basically like there's a giant canvas and every user can like alter one pixel like once every 5 minutes. And like thousands of people came together to turn this thing into their piece of art. Everybody grabbed a little corner of it, made their little contribution, like, and they fought for that territory and like tried to leave their mark on this canvas. And like the finished piece was this like breathtaking collage of digital culture. I love it. I love that. I think the internet is so cool, and I hate how much garbage came from it, but things like that, those kind of creative communities, those collective efforts, I love them. And people tell stories that exact same way, although with like, you know, perhaps a little bit less intention behind it. You get a bunch of people on a forum, like Facebook group, or like anybody commenting on the same media, fiction or nonfiction, what we might call in communications, a public. They're all negotiating meaning, right? They're all responding to and contributing to reality, both as individuals and like broadly as a collective. Like, it doesn't matter if they're writing fan fiction or decoding cue drops or asking for advice on installing an air conditioner or something. Like, they're adding their story to the public record, and they're adding just like a little thread to the tapestry of reality. No matter how much they understand themselves to be storytellers, they are.
I want to explore something that you mentioned, the idea of being able to tell a story with no spatial barriers, right? So you're no longer limited to the cave or to radio waves or whatever, but the internet kind of gives us the ability to broadcast infinitely or potentially infinitely. I want to explore this in two ways. One is, are there barriers real and imagined here within sort of within the online? And then, you know, sub point to that, who's creating those barriers, right? So if you have a bunch of communities, is there expectation that these creative communities or these communities of communication will have barriers set around them, you know, whether real or actual?
Yeah, well, like, there are some barriers to the internet. There are, like, obviously just very material access issues. If you don't have an internet connection or a device that can use an internet connection, you are cut off to some things. While the internet has lessened language barriers, has not eliminated them, there are communities that are private, that are pay to enter, or are just, like, you know, really esoteric or niche and aren't going to make sense or appeal to everybody. But like it or not, they're all part of the same ecosystem. They're all interacting. But for, like, who creates those barriers? I mean, other than people who build websites, right? Other than the either material or mechanical barriers that just exist anytime there's a negotiated physical digital space, a lot of the barriers are just social. Like, all right, if you go onto an empty bus and there's one other person there, it would be weird to take the seat next to them. Like, there's no rule, there's no law that says that you can't do that, but there is a, like, there is a social understanding that there are things that you don't do that are strange or uncomfortable or invasive. And those are the kind of social laws, like the social barriers that do still mediate collective storytelling, digital communities, any kind of social space, really. And if you go into a space that isn't yours and you break the rules, like, you're going to get a very curt, "We don't do that here," at which point you'll have to decide how you want to proceed. Like, the same laws that kind of govern regular human social interaction do still exist to some extent on the internet. They just look a little bit different because it's a different kind of space.
That's interesting. And then I guess my last question here would be sort of Benedict Anderson's, like, imagined communities. I wonder how much, like, it's been years since I read the book, so I'm going to totally screw it up, but I'm kind of curious, like, how many of these communities are just literally in people's minds? They're just kind of creating it, you know, like, you know, preference from software games or creepypastas, and then, you know, the space comes afterwards. So, like, first you have the conception of the idea of what you want of the community, and then kind of you begin to create the space around that community. Or is it the other way around, where you first have a space and then you fill it in with a community with those sort of social bonds?
I think both of those things are, I think there's a push-pull there, right? If there is one barrier that the internet absolutely eliminated, it was the challenge of finding other people like you. Which, if you were in a small town and you were, you know, the guy who loved Dark Souls, good luck finding a collective of friends in your town of 2,000 people who are also big Dark Souls fans, like, or whatever niche, bird watching, woodworking, like, no matter what your weird hobby or your fascination or your interests are, it's hard to find other people within your physical location who also love those things. The internet made that really easy, because now you can go to google.com and type in the thing that you want, and it'll show up. It'll be handed to you, a community of people who love it. And sometimes that community is very defined, very literal, like members of a particular forum or a group chat or like a Discord. You know, those things are like, there's an idea of membership and shared interest. Other times those communities are not imagined, but less centralized, right? There's a lot more like flow between those spaces and other ones, like on Tumblr, like you know, with a tagging system, you might see posts from other people's interests that aren't necessarily your interests, right? There's those things move in between the spaces. I love that part of the internet where these communities can exist in a way that they couldn't before. If there is one rule about the internet, it's that like if you can imagine a community, it's probably out there. And if it isn't out there, you can create it. As far as like, does it work the other way around? Like if there is a space, will there be people to fill it? I also think that part's true. Like there is a sort of like social diffusion that happens, right? Like if a community gets, you know, too big or too compact, right? If people get uncomfortable, it gets too weird. Like the natural thing to do is people spread out into the next unoccupied space and they fill it with the thing that doesn't yet exist, but does now. That is like, the internet didn't look like this 20 years ago. I mean, this is a decades long effort to fill every possible corner of the internet with every possible thing. It's brilliant. I mean, the internet is like this digital library of Alexandria. It's amazing. I love it. I love it. I love studying the internet. I hate that it feels many times like it has done more harm than good, but there is such value in these communities.
That's interesting that you make a comparison to the Library of Alexandria. Like any library kind of thrives on its sort of indexing and organization system. And, you know, when it comes to the internet, like finding a community is kind of important, finding and staying in the community. So how do we, you know, I guess in meet space, it's easy to find a community, right? You go to a local hacker collective or to the local gym or to the wherever, but on the online, finding things is, you know, you're at the whim of recommendation algorithms or SEO or, you know, a multitude of, you know, algorithms that are kind of mediating your experience to find communities. So I wonder, you know, in this discussion of the internet and how communities are formed, you know, where do we put in that sort of the software, so to speak, the algorithm, the sort of software that is mediating behaviors and searching and indexing?
It's a hard thing to answer because I feel like there is a temptation to attribute way too much about human behavior to the whims of the algorithm. I really try to push back against the idea that humans most of the time are ever passive consumers, right? That being said, the algorithm has changed how a lot of digital communities work. You know, it used to be that all of these forums, almost all of these spaces were pretty public, you know, but Tumblr, which was kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say the last fandom website because that's obviously bullshit, but it was the last one that wasn't governed by an algorithm where you had to tailor your own likes and dislikes and interests with like follows and the tagging system and finding new people. That was an effort you had to undertake yourself to kind of curate this environment. And, you know, that's not the case anymore. If you're on Twitter or Instagram or any of the other, you know, cool places the kids hang out, they're going to feed you stuff based on your interests. Oh, you liked watching the Avengers. We'll have you watch this other thing, right? It doesn't stop. And all those private communities that aren't constantly being fed stuff are like in more private places like Discord or, you know, other group chats, other platforms. I don't love what that has done to digital communities. It has kind of broken them apart in a lot of ways. And the ones that remain, because they get further and further from the public eye, get stranger and stranger in private, and in ways that they become toxic and kind of break the things that used to be really cool about digital communities. I think that there are a lot of people who still really cling to the old idea of the internet, and that there are like, it is a miracle that 4chan is like still a website, right? The UI hasn't gotten better ever. It's like the exact same terrible form now that it was when it was first born. It has the exact same terrible content. Like 4chan is a time capsule. Like every time somebody does one of those jokes, like, I wish we could bring Benjamin Franklin back to life and see what he thinks of today. Like, if you wanted to bring the year of our Lord, like 2005, back to life and see what they would think of today, that is, like, 4chan still exists. Like, it's the exact same thing there. I really want there to be some kind of revival of like parts of the old forum system. I mean, not the part where they were all like wildly unmoderated and just became hotbeds for hate speech, but the part where there were niche communities that were self-regulated, open to the public, and were governed by interest and not algorithm. I think that those communities had a lot to offer and are where some of the coolest like content and relationships came from, was that old system.
So it was kind of like, I had a recently weird experience with Twitter. Like, this is where I have a lot of community, or, you know, different researchers and like a sort of community there. And I went from a sequential timeline based on, you know, the earliest or the newest tweets on top, the oldest tweets on bottom, and then switching between that and sort of the most interactive ones. And it was just a completely kind of different experience. It was like just switching over between the two, I would see completely different communities and completely different groups of people. And it was just like, huh, you know, if I wasn't conscious that I was making this change, then this would be like, I would have probably met completely different people. Like it's just so wild that, like, you know, a subtle flick of the button, so to speak, or the switch is kind of can change how you view things and then how you can kind of go out and relate to people or saying, oh, that content is really cool, I want to, you know, follow that person, hang out with them or whatever. But I think there's just so much subtlety there, potential subtlety. It's not, you know, I think there tends to be like people make it out to be much more crass, like a much more crass mechanic than it actually is.
Yeah, obviously the algorithm has intentions, right? The algorithm was made by people who made the algorithm to increase engagement and increase ad revenue. But I also don't think that the algorithm, with the noted exception of some of Facebook stuff, I generally don't believe the algorithm to be an inherently malicious force. I think people talk about the algorithm like they, the same way they talk about the devil, like the algorithm's out to influence you, the algorithm's out to get you. Don't believe the things the algorithm shows you, which is like a type of Black Mirror thinking that I frankly don't have time for in my life. But like the Twitter thing is a fantastic example where, you know, they were experimenting with this feature. They wanted to see how it worked, and they made the rare choice to give users the option to have it or not. I, for one, turned it off. I like being able to manually curate the content I see. I like that I only want to see content from the people that I follow, and I want to see it in the order that they posted it. I don't want to see what the algorithm thinks they should see. I don't want to see what got the most engagement. I don't care what got the most engagement. That's not what's important to me as like for how I use the internet. Other people, especially if you're into like social media monitoring, might have very different intentions for how they use the internet. But I do think that art of having to curate your own digital experience is one of those things that will hurt humanity in the long run.
I think curation is so difficult. Like it's like, I've kind of noticed this, like on Twitter, it's just years of curation. Like I've been on Twitter for almost 20 years now, like since 2008. So, okay, less than 20 years, but a good portion of my adult life. And it's just like curation built on curation, and like communities built on communities, and like things are marginalized, things disappear. It's just such a neat like archaeology, or like in video game terms, it'd be lore, like searching for tweets from 2012.
And yeah, like, no, wow. The old Twitter lore. I do think Twitter is maybe the only website other than Tumblr, something awful, and like 4chan that I would truly say does have lore. Like you, like knowing the Twitter lore is like its own experience of being an extremely online person.
That's so true. Like horse Google, like the joke that we were constantly making, like the horse, yes. Google, hell on my iPad. I was like, somebody asked me like, where does that come from? Like where, like, was that a community? Was that like you individually being crazy? And then I looked it up and it was like, it was initially a tweet that I made based on horse ebooks like 12 years ago.
No, like, you made a joke that was so old, you forgot the origin. Like that is a new part. That's like a new type of being a Twitter guy. Like, I mean, you know, like this is, it's true for every website. Like, okay, every website has like their daily lore, right? But I mean, most of the stuff from like Tumblr and 4chan and something awful, like they all had their biggest hits, right? Like everybody can tell you about Grover House, right? Everybody can tell you about the grave robber girl from Tumblr. Everybody can talk about these things because they are sort of like they are the famous ones, right? Twitter is so rapid fire. Like it is a daily main character. Like it is, and each one of those things is their own little Twitter incident that like goes on the record as like, unfortunately, this person was the main character on this day. And the next time there is an incident involving them, it will be pulled from the archives and brought up again. And there are definitely plenty of things that like were memed to the point where their origin is no longer important. I think horse Google is a really funny one because it definitely has not left our orbit, but it will at some point. And like nobody will be able to figure out how the fuck that one started. I do love things like some of them are a little forced, right? Like you can tell when a weird meme phrase gets popular because some like fucking New Yorker article was like, all the teens are saying this word, and it's like, no, they're not, but now we are, I guess. And I think milkshake duck was one of those. Like that was not a word I saw anybody using organically until somebody wrote an article about it. And now people do actually use the phrase milkshake duck to refer to a person people thought was good and celebrated until it was revealed they were actually racist, which is a word we needed in the English lexicons. Like I'm kind of glad we have it now, but I do hate how weird and like forced it was in like adopting it into the language.
Yeah, that's, I never realized that. Like, it's just suddenly it's here. It's there, you know, milkshake duck.
Oh, yeah. Milkshake duck. That's now a word we have. And it's one that if I ever say it to anybody like who is not on Twitter, I'm going to have to like the amount of explaining I would have to do to get to the point of why I said that would be it would be much better just like, just let the joke go, let it go. It doesn't matter. Forget what I said. I don't want to explain this. It won't make anybody happy. Like I think internet lexicon getting adopted is always very funny. And we certainly do it a lot. I, for one, I know I'm guilty of having a lot of incomprehensible tweets if you don't have the right context of just, I understand all of these words individually and not together kind of tweets. And that just gets worse the more niche the communities you're in get.
I feel like we need like a Vatty explainer, or like I guess for the audience, Vatty is a kind of, he's the go-to guy from software lore, basically.
Oh yeah, the extremism researcher lore.
Oh no. Yeah, I mean, like, there's so much, like, every community has its lore, and it's just like, to your point, it's just in, like, when you go to that community, it's just like you're dealing with this weird history and sort of, I guess lore is history plus your own interpretation of it. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I know that's one of those things that can feel very overwhelming and is maybe part of the reason that some people like algorithms. I, for one, love playing the role of digital archaeologist. I love it when I see a meme 3 days late and I have to figure out where it came from and what people are talking about. I love it. Like that to me is fun. It's just another little thing I can add to my big wall of string of like how these communities connect to one another, how people talk to each other, how digital communications works. I know that not everybody enjoys the task of being a digital archaeologist, and they're like, I just want to know what people are tweeting about while I eat my Cheerios in the morning, and I don't want to have to do any work to understand the words people are saying, which valid. I can't argue with that. However, I do think it's good to take a little bit of joy in that curiosity.
So I want to maybe kind of switch footing. So we've discussed the communities, how people create communities, how they create lore, specific lexicons. So let's take, you know, another step and say, you know, how do we given all that, how do we understand the internet as a platform for creating political narratives? So you can, you know, define political narrative as however you want, but, you know, what is that step of going from a community with a specific lore and lexicon to a politically active community?
I mean, I'll save you the whole thing about how everything is politics. Blah, blah, blah. We've heard it 1,000 times. And I know some communications professors are going to listen to this and like get hives, but they'll live. So I have this sick delusion. All right. And it comes from my awful familiarity with digital subcultures and media narratives. And it's a bit of an everything looks like a nail situation. But I have this delusion that political narratives, like thinking beyond the party system, are functionally just narratives with intentions behind them. You know, narratives that are meant to change minds or sway discourse, narratives that are meant to contribute to like negotiated meaning and significance. And my terrible little thought about these narratives is that they are no different from any other type of storytelling. Maybe the most relevant difference about them is like the mindset of your audience. Like, what is the mindset of your audience? Like, what position are they in to receive these narratives? Because nobody likes to be sold to. But these political narratives are, like, they're just as highly manufactured as an organic result of storytelling, or as, you know, a concocted story built in a lab, you know, and just as much so as any work of fiction told around a fire. Like, I think there's a lot to say about how the internet as a delivery system has influenced political narratives. Like, we could talk for days about, because we were just talking about algorithms, right? Algorithms feed people politics, make them angrier. Like, these insular communities get like strange and violent with their own conspiracy theories when they're left alone too long, or, you know, how it's literally never been easier to infect an entire system with a particular narrative than it is now. But that's all, like, thanks to this revolutionary development of like everyone being able to send information to everyone at the speed of light. Like, what the hell, dude? That's crazy. That's never been done before. And we will never be able to fully unpack the consequences of giving that to humans. Like, the everything about human life is fundamentally altered because of the way that discourses are able to move on the internet. Like, whoa. But like, with that in mind, I think there's like an overlooked question. You know, we talk a lot about, well, how has the internet changed political narratives? But like, we don't usually talk about how political narratives shaped the internet. Like, there was a point in ye old internet, like before the big social media sites and the billionaires fighting over them, you know, that the internet was like, one, a realm for a particular type of tech nerd. And perhaps most importantly, two, was the last unexplored frontier before humanity could like conceivably colonize space or whatever. Like, it was not just a tool, but there was finally the space that could be claimed by people, right? A community untouchable by, you know, outsiders or elites or any of that, like a place for organizing or, you know, jokes or just regular old escapism. And people in ye old internet like thought that this newfangled digital ecosystem thing would be the kind of thing that could like take down the man. You know, it was lawless and unexplored. Its potential was limitless, right? And then eventually, like, you know, the forums consolidated or like disappeared, and like the hacker collectives got arrested and Zuckerberg took over, and like, you know, sort of the dreams of the libertarian cyberpunk like fell apart in a way, which is, you know, sucks. But the spirit of that, like, it never left the internet, right? Like, there is still a feeling amongst internet users, even the ones who like weren't alive to remember that era, that the internet is unconquerable. Like, they're like, the collective force of the internet is still a force to be reckoned with. And people hold that belief very, very dear. Like, you know, 4chan raids, you know, trolling internet polls, regular old dogpiling, hashtag Twitter do your thing. Like, let's make this go viral. There is an understanding that the internet is still a very powerful tool for attention and disruption that can be wielded by anyone if they play their cards right, you know? And the reason the internet looks the way it does now is because the bedrock political narratives about digital movement that inspired people to use the internet to make more political narratives. Like, that is why it exists, is the initial political narratives that helped make the internet, that have made the internet into a tool for more political narratives. Like, conscious or not, it's fascinating. And when I look at things like Elon Musk is like, I'm going to take over Twitter. Okay, whatever. But I've seen just as many tweets talking about how like, well, as Twitter users, here's how we can tank Twitter's stock. Like, as Twitter users, here's how we can run Elon Musk off the site. Hey, remember that time that we made Yahoo lose like several billion dollars on Tumblr because we made the site so bad no one wanted to buy it? Like, the internet still believes as a collective in their ability to affect, you know, the quote unquote real. And they absolutely delight in it. It's always great to watch. I think the GameStop shorting thing is another great example of people were like, with the power of posting, we're going to like pull one over on Wall Street. And I mean, kind of, you probably fucked over a couple of retirement funds, which is, you know, hey, good on you. But the excitement around it, that community around it of like, finally, the internet is coming into its own as the tool to stop the man. Like, yeah, I mean, they're still getting ad revenue off your posting, but like, I love the spirit. I love the energy we're bringing to this.
Would it be, in what you described, would it be accurate to describe it as kind of a decentralized narrative production? Or how would you sort of describe it? I mean, the only word that actually comes to my mind is decentralized, but I don't think that's accurate.
If you zoom out, then yeah, it's kind of decentralized. You have a bunch of little nodes that interact with each other in different ways, and like, it's a discourse machine. Discourse comes out of it, but not all the communities know that they're interacting. They don't all know how they affect each other. But the communities themselves are pretty centralized. Now, that doesn't mean they're coordinated, right? If you're arguing on a forum, if people are you know, negotiating meaning, as it were, they aren't necessarily working collectively to craft a particular narrative, they're working to insert each individual's little narrative into the broader story. I don't know. Like, I think it might be wrong to label the collective internet with some kind of intention, right? It's made up of too many little moving parts. It's made up of too many little communities that are under the delusion they operate distinct from each other. They don't have to understand the digital ecosystem for them to be a part of it, regardless of where they understand themselves. But I do think that decentralized is maybe not the right word for where the most potent narratives come from, right? Because things like 4chan, certainly not decentralized. Like those are a bunch of people circling one location for the purpose of usually doing one thing. It's the opposite of decentralized, unless we mean decentralized in the terms of like not being under the direction of a higher power, which, depending on which type of media manipulation you're looking at, I would say is often true. Most people are not doing internet narratives because they were directed by like one other person to do it. Now, there are definitely cases where, you know, foreign governments, opposition leaders, that kind of thing, absolutely put stuff on the internet with the intention of using it to their advantage. In which case, like, yeah, that's inorganic media campaigns, right? Like we can see that happen in real time. But I don't think that makes up the majority of the stuff we see coming out of the internet. I think in many ways, the internet is still, I don't want to say autonomous, but it's obviously not true. But I think they are still sporting some representation of the human psyche that is more or less accurate of the desires of the people using the internet. Not of humans as a whole, not of a political party as a whole. But I do think the internet is good at representing what people on the internet think and feel.
That's something interesting that you brought up. And I kind of want to explore that, because when I use the word decentralized within the questions, I meant it as a comparison to like video games. Like in video games, the narrator is kind of centralized. You kind of follow a story, you know, even, you know, regardless if it's like open world or a more structured narrative, there's always like a storyteller and you're always following a story. And that's kind of what I meant by centralized versus decentralized, where there's no, in the internet, there's no real storyteller, or there's so many storytellers and narrative creators that it's kind of, you end up having hundreds of nodes, so to speak. But mm-hmm. I kind of want to maybe like, let's dig into the fundamentals before we sort of really start exploring. But like, when we think about video games, what kind of insights do you get from video games in terms of narrative creation and telling stories? And then how would you compare that to what you just sort of laid out, you know, about the internet and about the online?
So as far as I'm concerned, there are exactly two things about video games that make them different from other storytelling mediums. Everybody wants to talk about violence and blah, 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 whatever. That's boring. There are two things, and they are interactivity and multiplayer. Plenty of mediums have audiovisual elements and digital integration and violent narratives or whatever, but no other lets you touch the story and then watch the story respond. And no other lets you do this within a large social network where collective engagement impacts the outcome. With the exception, of course, of like tabletop RPGs, which, as you know, video games are based on. So I think it's obvious how that compares to the internet, right? The internet is a place where you can directly interact with your subjects of interest, watch them respond, and you can do it with other people who are also interested in the same things as you. I do get kind of annoyed about some of the talk about like ARGs, because I'm more of the opinion that it's the same social dynamics that rule other forms of narrative construction rather than the more popular line of like every coordinated activity slash digital network is LARPing and or doing an ARG, as if that's like some kind of conspiracy theory of its own. But I mean, man, the human experience is about presenting a version of yourself that lets you be the person you want in the situation you're in, and then putting the pieces together and solving all the little puzzles that allow you to understand yourself in the context of something bigger. Are we not in a way all playing God's RPG or ARG, right? Like, are we not all live action role-playing by like embodying the self or whatever? I mean, we could talk about that all day. And it gets more obnoxious grad student, like the more you go. But I think video games and storytelling is maybe one of the most fascinating dynamics in like any humanities topic. And think about it. We are so often told stories, or we seek out stories, right? Is a method of either disseminating information or for entertainment or comfort, like whatever. But like, we don't usually get to decide how the stories we consume end. Right. Like one of my favorite things is to look at like player statistics for games with like morality systems. You know, like they're like Mass Effect. You know, there are games where you can make an objectively like abhorrent choice to like kill or betray a friend. Like you can do a genocide. You know, you can do something fucking terrible. And maybe the game gives you like a little reward for being horrible. Maybe you get some coin out of it. Maybe it lets you skip a mission. Maybe it like gives you points, you know, whatever. Maybe the game hits you with like the, well, you know, you need to break some eggs to make an omelet kind of thing. But the statistics almost always show that players overwhelmingly choose not to be a dick. Imagine that. Here in, you have this world with no real consequences. You have a task in mind, you know, save the kingdom, kill the leader, free the elves, like fucking whatever. And here you can do just a little war crime, just a little one to make your task easier. A crime that would like hurt no real people. And yet like people still regularly make the choice to not do that because it makes them feel bad. And most importantly, it breaks the flow of the story where they're supposed to be embodying a hero. Like that's crazy. That's totally irrational, right? Like, have you ever like reloaded like 5 hours of gameplay because you like accidentally said something mean to an NPC and it has no overall consequences of the game, but you're still like, I can't live with myself knowing I said something mean to this fake person. Like I definitely have, because I know how I want my story to look, and the story where I said something mean isn't the one I want to participate in. And, you know, obviously we can't get that detailed or in control when we're dealing with like reality, right? When we're dealing with our desire to leave our mark on the world, like via the internet, right? But I do think the drive to like move the story the way you want is similar. The goal is pretty different. You know, video games are, you know, you're usually, with the exception of some, you know, avant-garde things, your goal is to be the hero, solve the problem, save the day, be the good guy or whatever. And the internet, which has tapped into some types of hopelessness, you know, sometimes really leans into the feeling that they'd rather leave any mark at all, regardless of its impact. Now, the internet is driven by this, I know I said earlier, it's best not to try to label the internet with motivations as a collective, but I think if anyone had to try and do that, I would say the internet is driven by a deep desire to be seen, right? Everything that happens on the internet is to be seen. It's about attention. Video games give you a task. They let you fill in that story for yourself. But the grand narrative of the internet, you know, of humanity, even about our places in the world, our cultures, communities, whatever, our task fundamentally is recognition. Like that is what human beings want more than anything.
That's interesting. It seems like the similarities between video games and the internet and how sort of narrative is created is really similar, you know, interactivity, yeah, multiplayer. And then something that you kind of hinted at is the idea of a protagonist complex or a hero complex, or
yes,
to be seen. Could we maybe explore that a bit? Like the idea, because it almost seems like a protagonist complex would lend itself very much towards extremism, like in the sense of, you know, in-group or out-group, and then demonizing an out-group.
Yeah.
Like the in-group, we're the protagonists, we're the good guys, the out-group, they're the villain, they're the monster.
That's exactly how it works. Like if we're thinking about how extremist stories and narratives are related to, this is why I say it, all forms of storytelling are still just forms of storytelling. All of these things are vessels, right? Like they let you see yourself within them, become the main character. You're the hero, the martyr, savior. The game is real if you want it to be, but it's fake. If that's easier, you're doing a joke, you're serious, you're dying for the cause, you'll respawn at a save point. The internet is physical, but it isn't. It's real, but it's not. It's just these infinite layers of dissonance that let you take on the role you desire for whatever cause you want. You're saving the empire, restoring the caliphate, you know, doing it for the glory, the race, whatever. Like the stories that make good games are the same ones that make good movies, good books, good religions, good terrorists, right? Humans love stories. We need stories because they help us make sense of ourselves. They help us understand our relationship to the world and our fellow humans. And when it comes to, well, which ones are the bad ones? I don't know. It really depends on like which narrative you're devoted to and how far are you willing to go to make it real.
That issue of reality is kind of interesting to me because I feel like when I turn off Elden Ring, my immersion in that reality ends, right? I'm no longer in Limgrave. I'm no longer riding around on my horse ram doing wizard things.
Yeah.
But with the internet, I mean, the internet seems to have this unique ability, curse, I don't know, to bend reality or make it miss reality. I don't know what the term is, because I don't want to say it's unreal, because it's not, but it's not completely real. So maybe
no,
dig into that for us, the idea of reality.
Well, I would say that like while you are within the suspended reality of a video game, there is a concrete start and end to that story. And not even just within the game itself, but between you and your monitor. Like when you leave that game, you have left that game. That's not to say that there are people who are not like a little too into it, but that's a different issue. The internet has bled from its confines, right? It is really hard to be in a place that is untouched by the internet or untouched by the narratives of the internet. It is this inescapable behemoth, right? I could go all day about arguing how we understand the idea of physical space and whether or not the digital is also physical. I would argue functionally it is, but we have lost the ability to bind the internet in its place the way that we can for other types of stories and narratives. So when you finish watching a movie, you're done watching the movie. But when you put your phone on the nightstand, like before you go to sleep, yeah, you're not actively consuming the internet at that moment, but the physical space that you're occupying is still fully shaped by it. That's not true for Elden Ring.
That's kind of disturbing. Like I feel like, you know, to expand our example out, like I feel like video games, books, music, once you turn it off, you're no longer immersed in that reality. But like the internet is just all consuming. I mean, I hate using that phrase, like all consuming, like it's some sort of huge Leviathan just eating us. But here we are. That, I mean, that kind of fascinates me because, like, what is the mechanic there? What is this sort of, why is it that I can turn off Elden Ring and I'm no longer immersed in it, but the internet just is constantly persistent in its narratives? Is it simply because the mechanic is I spend more time on Twitter than I do playing Elden Ring, or is it something sort of deeper and sort of more, something deeper and something more substantial?
There's a lot of places you could take this. I mean, perhaps the most innocuous is that, you know what the purpose of Elden Ring is? It's to fucking play Elden Ring. And when you're done playing Elden Ring, Elden Ring is no longer relevant. The goal of the internet is everything. It's your job. It's your fun. It's where you talk to your friends. It's where you email your boss. It's where you make a doctor's appointment. It's where you order groceries. It's everything. You go to a restaurant, not to sound like a like one of our cool kind of QAnon runoffs at the moment. And like, yeah, you go to a restaurant, you scan a QR code, right? We are never disconnected. And that's not me making a judgment on whether or not being disconnected is good or bad. I think, hey, it's maybe not a bad thing to go to the woods for a week and like not touch online, because the discourses can get pretty noxious, especially if you haven't like worked overtime to curate your digital experience in a way that doesn't slowly make you insane. But the fact that the purpose of the internet is much more all-encompassing than something like Elden Ring. There's also the part where games have finite number of designers with intentions, right? Somebody writes a video game story, they have a purpose with that story. They know what they want to happen in that story. The internet is this thing made up of the opinions of every human being on Earth, which is psychically, a catastrophic amount of information for a human being to absorb at any given time. It also means that the internet is never disentangled from our real life experiences, because everything that makes up the internet is a reflection of what is happening in people's, again, I hate to say physical lives, but I'm, you know, non-digital lives. And people's non-digital lives are in turn being shaped by their experiences on the internet. These things are codependent. So I can turn off my PlayStation and go, I had a fun time playing Elden Ring. Time to not be playing Elden Ring. But it is much more difficult for me to disentangle myself from the capital O online.
And that lack of, you know, disentanglement kind of contributes to extremism, because I almost think like a video game has kind of limited linkages, right? You play Elden Ring, you can look at lore videos, there might be a community, but it doesn't necessarily, there's kind of a stopping point or a circle you can kind of draw around it. Whereas the online is like, I think about like, you know, how Twitter is kind of connected to the Tucker Carlson show, which then is connected to the broader sort of right wing. You know, it's the linkages of online produced narratives almost seem infinite. Or,
oh yeah,
as you kind of pointed out, the inability, you can't really disentangle yourself from it. Rather, it's being constantly promoted upward and repeated until you get somewhere, you know, where you just keep going, basically. Is that right? Or is there something more there?
When I think about like Tucker Carlson is a fascinating example of like kind of the bridge between the internet and the non-internet. And while there is, is there a lot of blame to go around for why the internet is the way it is and why it causes the problems it causes, there is also the very simple, innocuous explanation that the same things that make the internet awesome for all kinds of niche little communities of hobbyists. It ain't only niche little communities of like cool hobbyists that are going to use it. You're not only going to get bird watching groups. Like, you're also going to get a guy who's like, well, damn, I can't find any other fascists in my town. Better check the global internet. And like, that's why those networks are able to exist, the same way that all kinds of like, yeah, my hobby is building guitars. You know, my hobby is I make stained glass, whatever your weird thing is that there's maybe not a huge community for, you can find it and create it and nurture it with the internet. One of the problems with extremist groups is that extremism by definition is not popular, and it's hard to find buddies to do it with. The internet lifted that barrier the same way it did for fucking stamp collecting or like whatever other weird hobbies people have. That also means it has its claws in the, you know, non-internet social networks, if you can even call it that. Things like Tucker's show, while they are also being shown in nursing homes to people who are not on Twitter, is also made up of people who are online and who publish online. Tucker's clips go viral online. These things are still codependent. They are still affecting each other.
I feel like that's, it almost seems like the inability to disentangle yourself from the internet, like there has to be a comment about like identity, like something deeper, but you know, I'm kind of circling around it, but I can't, I don't know what, I don't have the vocabulary for it, because it's like, you know, I'm a big fan of From Software games, but I can disentangle myself from it as an individual, and it's not an identity. Whereas
no,
people can't disentangle themselves from the internet, and suddenly their online identity becomes their offline identity, which is kind of scary when we sort of discuss this in the context of sort of fascism and neo-fascism.
Yeah, I mean, fandom as politics, fandom as identity, like there's a lot of truth to those kind of things. And like, hey, well, maybe being a Dark Souls fan isn't usually an entire personality. There was a very concentrated effort to make being a gamer its own identity, which I know I talked about in our last little Loopcast episode about that and Gamergate. And there is an understanding that digital identities, digital soldiers, whatever movement you're associating yourself with, is a very powerful identity if you can make the individuals feel both marginalized and important enough to make it an identity, one that does follow you when you log off Twitter for the night, or you know, when you go and visit your family, that these are still identities that are important to you. I think we're going to see a lot more of those, and they're not all bad, but the ones we end up having to learn about usually are. Usually we don't hear about the good ones. We don't always hear about the nice ones. We don't hear about the nice bird watchers.
No, you don't. You never hear about the bird watchers or the stamp guys.
No.
It's always a negative sort of things. So I want to maybe take a kind of a step into something else, and something that kind of fascinates me, which is the idea of an author or a narrative designer. Because you made this great point that in video games, you have a kind of a finite number of designers. You have maybe for the listeners, maybe like two or three writers. You have a production designer. You have essentially a limited amount of people who are working on a video game's narrative design, and it's sort of both written and sort of physical expression of that narrative design. But on the internet, you have, I want to say almost an infinite number of designers. Not only infinite, but they're also like strangers to each other, right? So I think like creepypastas, the famous one, The Cove, the one where it's kind of it's presented as like different people kind of representing their memories. But in that sense, you know, kind of discuss, you know, the idea of an author or a narrative designer when we talk about online narratives.
I mean, we could take this as far as we want, right? We could take this even off the internet. How much does God value free will? Are we in like a rock star kind of open world game where like you follow the narrative from point A to point B and call it choice? Or are we doing like an Elden Ring and just like fucking it up on this big ass map? Like, see, no, wait, let's do the video game Protestant Reformation. Let's do video game Calvinism. Let's decide like about our free will. Who weaves my fate? Is God or FromSoft my puppet master? I don't know. It's a hard thing to answer because you're absolutely right. The internet is made up of the intentions and the will of 1,000 different people, 1,000 different motivations to the power of 100. Like it's so much content. That's part of the reason it makes people so weird when it tries to be a representation of collective will and it's actually this like amorphous blob of voices talking over each other and just all kinds of stuff, right? But when we think about narrative design in video games, yeah, I mean, it depends on how much they trust their player when they're building an open world, what kind of experience they want to make. Like, is this a story that needs to happen in order? Is it about role-playing or discovery, right? Is the storytelling environmental, or do I need to get a ton of like exposition from NPCs? Do I need to go keep clicking X in front of a guy until he tells me all the lore, right? And like a good video game, a really good video game, has a really supportive relationship between developers and writers where the mechanics and the maps enhance the storytelling and then the storytelling adds significance to the gameplay and experience. Really good really good ARGs do that too, right? Where you have storytelling that also takes advantage of the mechanics of the internet to the point that they enhance one another. But like, oh man, I think my favorite example of really clever narrative design and a positive relationship between developers and writers is The Outer Wilds, which is a game with no quests, no objectives, no combat. It's not like a walking sim or a point and click, but you're just like a little alien guy in a shitty wooden spaceship and you are told to go explore the cosmos and you might crash, your autopilot might fly you into the sun, or you know, you could die from like any of the existential horrors that happen when you're dealing with like quantum mechanics or being on another planet, whatever. But the good news is you're in a time loop, so hooray. If you die, you'll come back. But you get to decide what you want to do with that information. It's ultimately this amazing story about resilience and acceptance and understanding. And strangely, for a video game, the really humbling role of bearing witness to change rather than being the force behind it. And that sometimes the responsibility of a conscious being is just to see. And every awkward mechanic or rough landing in this game contributes to that experience of like eventually coming to terms with the fact that your responsibility here is not to save the world. It is to be the person that sends it off. I really recommend everybody check it out. It's an incredible video game. And it's one of those things that is really important to me when I think about the construction of narratives on the internet and what is my role or contribution to shaping those narratives. As internet users, none of us are passive. Every time we send something out there, we cause just a little ripple in the water, and who knows how it affects the big picture, right? We can't see that. We can zoom out all we want and it'll all just become mud at some point. But I mean, I certainly try not to have any delusions that like I can fix it all, but to what extent is my responsibility just to understand it, to see it for what it is, to recognize it the way all humans want to be recognized? I don't know. Sometimes I think that might be the best I can do.
So when we begin to think about narratives on extremist narratives, I mean, like I think about QAnon a lot in the sense that it was kind of this weird primordial, like, you know, bits of the story were, you know, were chosen by a mediator, and those, you know, bits of the story or the bread or whatever was kind of elevated. And then that becomes part of the Q canon, as much as, you know, a canon can exist. But I mean, I'm kind of interested, like, when we look at extremist narratives, like, what is the mechanic there then? Is it, I mean, do we have to consider it kind of more emergent, you know, less dependent on an author, less dependent on centralization, and then the narrative is really like via, you know, it's an emergent design thing where you have, you know, hundreds of voices that kind of circle around the same idea.
Like, I think extremist narratives, I mean, I really like the idea. It is funny to think about the concept of like a decentralized extremist narrative, like an open world extremism. Like I'm like imagining an infiltrator from like one group to another, getting kicked out for griefing and being told that, you know, no Fed posting my Minecraft server. But I think extremist narratives have always been this collection of empty signifiers to some extent. You ask someone why they do the things they do, and they'll tell you freedom or liberty or for the white race. And like, what do those things even mean? I mean, clearly they're important if you're willing to die for them, but they are not concepts with agreed upon definitions. The point of discourse is to negotiate those definitions, but the point of good extremist narratives is to leave them open enough that anyone with shit to be mad about can find a reason to participate. Gotta go like, sure, you know, I can see myself within this narrative. I can see where I have a place. And maybe that is the more significant relationship to video games, which is the task of writing a story where you both have a protagonist, but that protagonist is also a mirror upon which the player can view themselves. Like, obviously, not all video game narratives try to do this, but plenty do. It's a really hard line to walk between having enough of a personality to be interesting, but not so much to be alienating when you're designing a protagonist. You know, we could do 10 podcasts on the art of writing an audience stand-in, which is why I think some of those more open narratives when we're talking about extremist stuff, something like QAnon, for example, well, what kind of digital soldier are you? Like, where do you fit into this? That's a little bit of self-determination that people are handed. It's empowering in a way that there is this sort of inevitable thing happening, you know, the arrests, the tribulations, the drain in the swamp, the storm is coming. Okay. These events are set in stone. They are prophecy. So what are you going to do? Where do you get to be part of this thing? You're already special because you learned about it before everybody else. So it was a special member of this collective of understanders of the thing. What kind of protagonist are you going to be? And I think everybody kind of comes up with slightly different versions of it that fit for them and that make them feel good. But you'll watch these groups kind of start to fall apart when they are ever pressed to come up with a collective definition. And they'll argue over who is white enough and who is not white. The funniest was with the Proud Boys, when people were like, hey, the Proud Boys are a white supremacist group. And one group of Proud Boys was like, no, we're not. And we object to the idea that we are white supremacists. And then a bunch of other Proud Boys said, wait a second, we're not white supremacists? What do you mean we're not white? I'm here specifically for the white supremacy. And that caused like, that caused a split in their organization, because there was an argument over like, wait, hang on. What did you mean by Western chauvinist? I know what I meant by Western chauvinist. What did you mean by Western chauvinist? And what their actual responsibilities for bringing about that reality were. It's fascinating. Like, the best thing that they can do to keep group cohesion is keep their intentions vague and don't ever press on people's individual understandings of what these words mean.
That's an interesting idea. The idea of an open narrative. Like, it's It's like you're open sourcing your ideology almost. And, you know, you don't want to press too hard, lest an individual kind of says, well, no, that's not what I mean. That's kind of it. I mean, that's kind of blowing my mind, like the idea of an open narrative, because it does lead me to this idea or this question of how original are these narratives? Like, I think, you know, I hate going back to Q, but like a lot of Q stuff is just recycled. It's just, you know, old anti-Semitism, old government conspiracies, just kind of repackaged, reworked, and then re-expressed, but it's at its core doesn't seem that original. So
it's within not.
So within your laying out of the idea of an open narrative, how important is originality or novelness to that concept? Is it just easier for a designer to kind of just repeat what's already been said, just in a different way?
Well, that's one of those things where there's not always a designer, right? A lot of these things are, for all intents and purposes, decentralized. They are maybe people who are maybe observing the same thing, getting mad at the same people, but they don't usually have an individual manifesto, right? There's not usually a, like, here's my party and here's what we believe. It's much more, do we all hate the right folks? Which is good up until a certain point, and then it's not. Is originality important? I would say not really. Definitely a lot of extremist groups try to pretend that they're different, right? Well, we're not that. The other group got by feds, but we won't because we're different. And it's like, you are already infiltrated, my friend. But for the most part, same books, same narratives. And this is not even just about fascists. Like, I mean, I just wrote that paper with Mark and Amar on narrative syncretism between jihadists and accelerationists. And it's like, it's the same shit. It's the same thing. Like, the ways in which you get somebody to do crimes like that, it's basically the same fundamental belief system you have to have, right? And they don't care very much that those ideas are not original. Sometimes they prefer it because they see it as, you know, returning to a more traditional belief system. They want to participate with that. They want to be in touch with that. But to the extent to which they feel the need to be different, I mean, only in the initial branding, not ideologically.
That's interesting. So it almost seems like, I hate saying it, like horseshoe theory, like where it's the narrative creation of two extremist groups that you think are on the opposite ends of beliefs are really kind of reflecting one another, right? No.
Maybe. I would more say that there's a lot of problems with horseshoe theory, but perhaps the biggest is that it proposes a dichotomy where either side has an agreed upon set of beliefs that they adhere to. And the more extreme you get, the more you need like a Z-axis. You are no longer dealing with one or the other. They are picking and choosing narratives and beliefs that suit them. And it doesn't exist within the two-party system or broadly left and right understanding of politics anyway. If the groups feel fundamentally opposite to each other, but they're not fighting, then there is some kind of coalition happening. And people have a lot of reasons for forming alliances of convenience, right? Is it enemy of my enemy kind of thing? A lot of times it is. Is it an agreed upon task that needs to happen that they're willing to participate in, whether it's, you know, destruction of the state or crushing a particular bill or doing certain types of hate crimes? Maybe. But I still think horseshoe theory is very goofy because it proposes this version of things where, like, if you go to the far left, that there are things that it means to be far left. There are things you believe as a participant of the far left, and that those things are agreed upon and understood as a collective member of the quote unquote capital F, capital L, far left. And that there is therefore a similar thing on the right. And no, there's it's still as much insane infighting and different philosophical branches and arguments, and they don't all agree on stuff. And one fringe group on the far right might be willing to do something that another one is not. Same thing on the quote unquote far left, are dangerous Antifas. There is no consensus that could make such a thing make sense beyond the reasons any two groups would align, regardless of their political affiliation.
So something that fascinates me that you've touched on and multiple other people have touched on is the idea of syncretism. If I could pronounce things, that'd be nice. Do you see that in video games? Like, I always feel like there's not a lot of genre bending in video games that much. Like, there's, once you kind of have slotted yourself into like an RPG, then it's just like the decision to, you know, how much action you're going to put into it, how much less action. I mean, we're like big studio games, obviously, if there's independent games. But
I think Gamergate was one of those debates, wasn't it? Where some folks really didn't like that genre bending was happening. I mean, there were a lot of things they didn't like, particularly that people who weren't men and weren't white were participating in the creation of and enjoyment of video games. But one of the central arguments was about what does qualify as a video game. And that they were like, well, there are certain things you have to have in a video game for it to be a video game. And other people who wanted to play with the genre a bit, try different styles, try different things, were kind of being pushed out. And I think that very much hurt, you know, creativity for a little while immediately post Gamergate, where nobody wanted to rock the boat, nobody wanted to piss people off. But there have been a lot of really exciting and really creative, really unique things to come out of that later, of people genre bending, trying to tie two types of narratives together. I don't know how much of it relates to syncretism in the sense that, like, when we're talking about it, we mean sort of the shared or at least parallel narratives between quote unquote ideologically disparate groups that might make them align or at least end up running in the same circles. I think actually maybe one of the great examples of that happening in video games is the game Control, which is based on a like collective internet creative writing project, basically, known as SCP, where folks fill in their own, like, their own kind of creepypasta. People write their own monsters. Then there's deep lore, and it's a collective creative project. People go on the forums and they, you know, work the stuff out together, and everybody contributes, and it creates this big picture. And then they based a video game off of that. A video game which in many ways has to be somewhat linear and has to have some kind of rules, has to have protagonists, you know, has to have these things that aren't present on a big internet creative project like that. And I love that game. I think it's really, really neat, but it is a fascinating glimpse into what it looks like when you start combining different kinds of media like that in a way that's cool. Not in like the stupid way where they keep trying to make every video game into a TV show. And then it's like, well, not only do you not understand what makes the medium good, but this is like an obviously kind of shallow IP grab. But Control is the opposite. It was like, how can we enhance and make this content accessible for a different audience? And I think that is just really, really neat.
I mean, do you see a similar mechanic with extremist narratives where it's cooperation, working together to make a narrative, to not only as coming together to build a narrative, but also make it accessible for people? Like, I'm just sure. kind of, I'm kind of circling around the idea of, we know there's extremist narratives, you know, they're produced online, but what is the kind of the mechanics and the sort of the mechanics of the development phase? Like where are very online people getting their ideas from and kind of making them extreme, basically?
Oh, yeah. Well, one, there are definitely a lot of like very direct efforts where one guy will look at a community and be like, that seems like something I can use. And then we'll either craft a narrative about it or craft a narrative from it and then use that to spread extremism elsewhere. They also frequently borrow from other extremist groups, other religions, other cultures, and be like, hey, this thing worked well for you guys. I'm going to work that into my thing. That has been, I think, a lot of the stuff that makes up all of like traditionalism, right? Is that type of syncretism. We're going to have a little bit of Hinduism in here. Some of us are going to convert to Islam. We're going to work all of these things into our narratives to make one that we think is effective. Certainly, the culture war aspect of this game is really important too, where your Southern strategy, right? The idea itself won't sell unless you attach it to something that people are willing to be mad online about, meaning you need to do a stupid culture war thing. And the stupid culture war thing, unfortunately, has a really good success rate and is one of those fantastic opportunities for the internet to showcase its attention-grabbing powers. And y'all have heard me talk about Gamergate. The last episode was Gamergate. Great example of doing that. Hey, we want to spread anti-social justice warrior, vague anti-progressivism statements. We're going to do it through the lens of gaming because that's the community we think we can get the most mad. And that is almost like the media marketing angle of it, right? That is beyond the part where one type of extremist will read the manifesto from another type of extremist and go, great, I'm going to write my own book now. And I'm going to create my own thing based on the collective efforts of a lot of shooters before me. That is real. Those types of overlap are very, very intentional. But there's also just the simpler part of like, depending on how far you want to go back in human history, where the original crossover happened, a lot of cultures share an affinity for hypermasculinity, legacy, nationalism, religious nationalism, in addition to, you know, the other kind, ethno-nationalism, an affinity for tradition, traditional family structure. Like these are things that have been important to, I think, maybe most civilizations. And it's no surprise that they are the kind of the things that are reverted to when people need to do extremism, and that they are also the fundamental points of overlap between extremist groups.
Interesting. I want to kind of switch footing. So we've been talking about video games, the online, and we have yet to get to visual design. And I didn't quite know how to kind of phrase this question. So I just want to maybe start with being very blunt, which is, you know, what do video games teach us about the visual design of extremism? So not just the memes, not just, you know, kind of the simplistic imagery, but sort of the visual design, the big sort of eye-grabbing pieces and sort of aesthetics of it all.
Yeah, well, we've already kind of talked about how one of the things that video games and good propaganda share is the ability to insert yourself into the narrative and participate in it to some extent. And good video games are nothing without their visuals. You need the narrative to give meaning to the visuals, and you need the visuals to enhance the narrative. Those things have to work together. But extremism almost universally has a couple of very particular requirements, right? like extremism always has some kind of aesthetic of decay. Extremism loves decay. It's really hard to convince somebody to like, you know, rage against a very nice machine, you know, but you tell them everything they love is crumbling and the ruins of the old can be made new again. You know, if only the wretched fog of modernity is lifted, right? Yeah, dude, they'll rage against that all day. This is not even specific to fascists. This is a favored thing of anybody who wants to break stuff. So if you want to visually design extremism, decay is going to be a big part of it. It's where a lot of the vaporwave stuff comes from, right? But I mean, even beyond decay, great. Okay, you're the protagonist. In extremism narratives, you have to be the protagonist. You have to serve something. Doesn't matter what, your race, your country, ideals, whatever. You know, you hate what's happening now. You want it to be different. This is war. And what they don't tell you about war is that, yeah, sure, tactics are important or whatever, but war is about vibes. You know, this is a fantasy war. This is a storytelling war. What kind of armor are you wearing? Like, does it look cool? You know, is it like a fitted breastplate or like a tactical surplus kind of deal? You know, like what archetype are you embodying as your kind of warrior guy? Are you the warrior male, like a homesteader? You know, are you like a monk or a crusader? You know, maybe you're a girl. Are you like a Valkyrie? You know, that's interesting. You know, and what are you fighting for? You know, are you looking at pictures of like white women in fields, or are you dreaming of your like perfect anarcho-primitivist commune? You know, who are you mad at? You're gonna be mad at somebody. Who are you mad at? Is it like, maybe they're doing the classic anti-Semitic caricature of like a greedy banker, or you know, drag queens reading to children, or is it like loud feminists and, you know, loose women, whatever? Like, these are all roles that somebody has to play in your story. You have to cast a character for each part of this, or it falls apart. It's the same things that are part of telling any good story. And you have to assemble it yourself, and it has to look good. Right? It has to look cool. If it doesn't look cool, this is the problem. This is the problem with fascism. Problem, I mean, extremism broadly, but especially with fascism, is like, fascism does not justify its own existence. If you say, we need fascism, people will say, why? And you better have an answer ready. And it has to be a compelling one. We need fascism. We need authoritarianism because, like, the enemy that's both strong and weak echoes entire creed. Okay. Like, you need to tell that story. Fascism is fundamentally about telling the story that makes people feel that they need fascism. And because the substance behind that story is not fucking real, you have to fake it till you make it. You have to look the part. You have to have the statues of you have the Greek statues, right? You have to embody the warrior male. You have to be shredded. You have to show the armies marching. You have to have the parades, the whole hurrah, right? You need to have the entire thing that says this is real, that gives people a thing to latch on to, because if you think about it too hard, it's stupid. And then it doesn't work anymore because people don't believe in it. So fundamentally, with, you know, the aesthetics of extremist propaganda, there's a reason that it all looks the same. And it's not just because of like the digital overlapping, right? It's not just that they're all sipping from the same 4chan pond, although that's true. But they all have to coat their stuff in like this filter of digital decay, you know, glitches and VHS footage, corrupted images, because like that's how they see the modern age. That's how they remember the internet. It's always about deciding what character you want to embody and then what you want that visual expression to be. And that visual expression at the moment, because of the places people are and how history is remembered to the young people that are now currently doing extremism, it looks like vaporwave. Like that is what has taken over. It's fash wave, right? That is the new game. I mean, I think not dissimilar to how like every big game for 20 years was all military aesthetic.
I mean, what kind of fascinates me about like this idea of aesthetics is that you don't need verbal communication, and you don't need like the word, so to speak. Like I think about I think about like Bloodborne or Elden Ring, like how much of that narrative of those two worlds is just communicated by you just kind of traveling around, like looking at the world.
It's about setting a tone, right? Yeah, it's about looking at feeling the grim dark, or you know, Elden Ring is a bit brighter, you know, but it's like I joke, but I'm also totally serious. War is about vibes. Like if you're doing war, you have to have the vibes right, at least from a media angle. You're right, the language element not being important. One of my favorite little terrible extremism party tricks is to have somebody ask me to find a guy. Doesn't matter what guy, it doesn't matter what type of guy. And like, okay, Emmy, we want you to, can you find me find me a Hezbollah guy? And I'm like, okay. Like, I'm going to start here at Nazis, and I'm going to keep clicking on pictures. And then when I reach Kingdom of Heaven, I'm going to take a right. And like, that's how we're going to navigate from one extremist community to the other. Language barrier eliminated, just by following the aesthetic cues. Okay, now they're both looking at, you know, kind of war wave material, or I know that they're both going to be looking at this. And you keep following that path until you find the next type of extremist. It's really easy to do when you're familiar with the discourses, but the part where it eliminates the language barrier is exactly the reason I get so frustrated that people underestimate the significance of Instagram in extremist media, because it's also the hardest website to pull from, because most algorithms, you can't keyword search by images. So you have to know what you're looking for.
That's the most screwed up version of 5 degrees of Kevin Bacon that I've ever heard.
Yes. Yeah, it totally is. Yeah, it's, again, I told you it's a terrible party trick, but you know, I work in the space now, so this is who I am.
But I mean, like, it almost seems like you're circling around the idea of that aesthetics are kind of universal, right? You can navigate from Nazi groups to Hezbollah, or Hezbollah to Nazi groups, simply on the power of not only their images, but the structure of the image, sort of like broadly defined as vaporware or whatever. Or is there something a little more deeper to how you're navigating the search?
It's about knowing which visual elements would support which narratives. And if I know that the visual elements from one movie are popular with both, then I make it my effort to find my way there. Much like the Kevin Bacon thing, or like the Wikipedia game, you keep following things in your head with associated keywords until you find the right groups posting the right images that support the right narratives. I don't know that that would have been entirely true in a pre-internet era to the same extent it is now, because aesthetics were more ruled by, like, you know, local culture, depending on, you know, what you were doing. But some of the grand displays, yeah, there's a reason why every dictator loved a parade. Everybody loved a show of force, right? Those are aesthetic choices that aren't necessarily because everybody was on the internet at the same time. Those are older than that, right? Everybody loves demonstrations of strength, you know, demonstrations of patriotism. You know, these are aesthetic choices that, while they might be more specific to an individual community, what that looks like, the sentiment behind it is the same. And it's because everybody on Earth now pretty much has a camera and can upload directly to the internet, there's a lot more cross-pollination between those things. But I mean, functionally, it's not very different.
So to kind of fuse our this conversation with a kind of what we've previously talked about today, I kind of want to tell you a story about environmental activists on TikTok. And It was so crazy because I started at something kind of moderate, like the aesthetics, you know, the forest, the cabin, the, you know, revitalizing.
Which cabin?
Exactly.
Which cabin specifically?
Yeah. So I started like going down this hole on TikTok. I'm like, oh, this is kind of cool. I've never heard of this. And then it just, the more I searched, the more extreme it kind of got, right? So it was environmentalism, then monkey spiking, I think the term is. So like environment, like sabotage. And then it just took me to like more and more extremist places to where the account that I ended with was basically Teddy K posting on Maine.
Yep.
That'll
happen, man.
You gotta
watch out for that.
Yeah, that was, it was quite a journey. But I mean, when we talk about like shared imagery, like it's like aesthetics seem like imagery and aesthetics just seem so, like it just seems like such an avenue to like quickly kind of funnel people into more extreme versions of that image.
Yeah, it's an attention span thing, especially with things like TikTok or Twitter, where it's constant barrage of information. Who has time to read and evaluate stuff? Nobody has time for that. Like images are the fastest way to make your brain acknowledge something.
Definitely, definitely. And it's just like, I don't know, it almost feels like it's something like kind of simpler for that background processing, right? Oh, you like environmentalism. Let's get you hooked more onto the platform. Here's some Teddy K posting or something. Like it's just,
whoops.
Yeah, you go from like the simplest and most wholesome form of the image to its most extreme and sort of violent. Like, which it's just kind of mind blowing. It almost seems like you kind of have a similar dynamic in video games. Like it's, like from a simple kind of sprite to the like almost Mortal Kombat or Doom level of violence, like something that really pulls in an audience, so to speak.
I would counter that by saying, I think the difference between that and video games, that video games are not truly a slippery slope. They are individual communities with their own individual interests. Like I don't think one necessarily starts at Pokemon and like fucks up the algorithm enough that they end up at Doom. Like I don't think that's quite how the interests play out, the same way it is like, oh, I believe in environmentalism. Ah, beans, that's the Unabomber, which does happen if you like engage too much in the wrong ways. And you know, the algorithm makes choices for you, but also people from different communities are actively trying to influence other communities. So if you're from the more extreme version of environmentalism, it might behoove you to see if you can pick up some of the normies like that. Hey, that's a recruitment pool. If you can get them there, right? If you can make the images that look cool enough, make the posters that are compelling enough, tell the right story. Like there are people who actively want that to happen, even beyond just the accidental whims of like having created a monster with the algorithm.
That's really fascinating. Like I kind of like the way you put it. Like there's no slippery slope between Pokemon and Doom. Like there's no capturing Pikachus one day and then listening to, you know, Mick Gordon's shredding soundtrack the next. But I mean, that's interesting because at its core, it seems like there's a difficulty of choice, that in video games, you still have the choice between going from, you know, something mundane and kind of wholesome like Mario and Pokemon to something more brutal like Doom or Mortal Kombat. Whereas online, you make it seem like choice is much more clouded. You're always being influenced. You're always being gamed and pushed as a member of an audience.
Yes, that is one of the things that's really interesting about the internet, is that it makes those things visible in a way that they usually are not. Even in here in meat space, we are always being influenced by our surroundings, the people we talk to, the weather, where we are, the time of day, everything. All of these things are affecting how we think, how we feel, what we say, what we do. And there are those infinite variables are not something we can tally at the end of the day. The internet is different. I can check exactly how many notifications I got. I can tell you exactly who I talked to and what was said. I can tell you who they talked to and what was said. I can tell you which memes came across my computer. I can tell you like which things I read, which things I learned. So you can watch communities and ideas and spaces shift in real time, which sociologically is an incredible boon, and also maybe peels back the curtain a little bit on human people in a way that maybe we weren't ever meant to know about. But when I think of something like, you know, how does one get from Pokemon to Doom? Well, the good news is there's nothing wrong with liking either of those things. If you love Doom, if you love the violent video games, if you love Mortal Kombat, like, it's not because you were video game radicalized. It's because there are particular mechanics or aesthetics or narratives that you find enjoyable, and those particular things work for you. If you end up on the wrong side of politics, though, if you go down that deep, dark rabbit hole, which is much more of a gradient than, say, are you playing game A or game B? Because you can certainly get really close to the I love the Unabomber orbit without ever stepping into the I love the Unabomber orbit. But you can enter that kind of gray zone where I'm going to start side-eyeing you. Like, that's very possible. Those gradients are real and complicated. They are less of a matter of preference and enjoyment and more about severity and the extent to which you believe in the story you're telling. I think when you get into communities where there are names of your favorite martyrs and your favorite people who have gone for the cause, both in good and in bad places. Like, hey, talking about important figures in the civil rights movement, awesome. That's good stuff. But it is also part of a story, right? It's a part of storytelling. Is including these things in a context that makes them more compelling, that makes them motivational, that makes them aspirational. You can do the same thing with people that are bad. And when people do that same thing with people that are bad, we need to acknowledge the power of that and understand what it means. And getting into extremist stuff, getting off the deep end, getting into the version of things where, like, you are willing to be violent, you have to have something a little bit aspirational. Or no one wants to shoot first. That's scary. That's dangerous. We don't do that around here. You have to hope that somebody else did it before you, and then you can follow in their footsteps and work that into your story, into the version of this where you're the protagonist. You're going to finish what they started.
Interesting. That's kind of blowing my mind, because that describes the environmental extremist post on TikTok almost perfectly. Like, it's, Even if you kind of cut out the Teddy K stuff, it's like, you know, the earth is dying, or, you know, we got this world and now we have to improve it. But it's always their solution for that decay and that sort of affront is almost like at least in the posts that I saw, was almost always the aesthetic of violence. It was, you know, or rule breaking, and it's still blowing my mind. I just came to it almost not naturally, but it was just presented to me. And it was just like, huh. Like, because there's no clues within the TikTok representation that this was an extremist group. They were only kind of, you know, you had to kind of dig further to get to that sort of extremist narrative. But the imagery was like, yeah, the earth is dying. You have to do something about it.
Don't get banned for photos. You do get banned for posting manifestos.
That's an excellent way to put it. You don't get banned for photos. You get banned for manifestos. That's kind of very mimetic of you.
Yeah. Happy to kind of throw my hat in the ring on the conversation about mimetic warfare.
So we've been talking about for about an hour and a half, and I think we've answered a lot of questions, but I do have to, before we go for the day, pose the legendary last question that we're all kind of famous for, which is, you know, before we go for the day, give us something as audience members to chew on, to think about, something to kind of, you know, either for further research or to think about when it comes to narrative design and the online.
I think if I wanted people to take anything away from this, for one, I think embracing and loving storytelling, also understanding storytelling, are some of the most critical skills to have if, I mean, in general, but especially if you're working with extremism and disinfo, because ultimately what you were looking at is different types of storytelling, different types of persuasive storytelling, stories that move you, stories that make you think, that make you want to do stuff. That's important. Understanding how that works is really, really important. The other thing I would ask people to think about more, especially my fellow researchers who I know are usually the people who listen to this, is the idea that our job is to understand the conditions more than the details. I think it's really easy to get caught up going, I found a TikTok where they were Uncle Ted posting. Okay, that's important. But what's more important is, what are the conditions around that? What does that network look like? What does that aesthetic movement look like? Beyond just the individual post, there's a little ecosystem there. You got to take the temperature in that node. You have to find out what that looks like, and you have to understand, like, what conditions lead to this, and how do these conditions help create the future conditions for violence. That is the thing that we need to get better at as researchers, as human beings, as users of the internet, is understanding the conditions. If we can look at the ingredients that make things right for something terrible to happen, or something good to happen, or for a discourse to leave its orbit, or for a discourse to enter an orbit, when one community is picking up something from another community. And it sounds like a lot, right? Like, how do I go into the panopticon of the internet and look at every space all at once? And what I would tell you is that you don't have to. And a really good experiment I recommend anybody try is start at one community, could be any community, like monster trucks, I don't know, something innocuous, right? I'm not going to tell people to go hunt for terror material. Please don't. And then see how quickly you can get from one community to another. So I don't know, monster trucks and chess fans, and just see how long it takes you to, like, find yourself at the part of the internet where people are talking about chess moves from a monster truck Instagram. Like anything like that will give you a better understanding of how these things are interconnected and how they interact with each other than all of the reading about individual groups or disinformation tactics. That is my advice to you, is to poke around in this space and play with it and see what kind of threads you can follow. But as always, please do not go hunting for extremist material. Don't do that. It's not good for you. It's bad. They want you to do it. It's a ploy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Don't do it. Go look at monster trucks. That's my advice. Hey, everybody should go get really into monster trucks. I think they're great. They're these really big cars, and they're, like, bigger than regular cars, and they drive over other cars and smash them real bad. And it's really cool. One did a front flip one time, like, over a school bus. Highly recommend that video. It's great. Go look at, if you heard all of that other stuff and you were like, all right, I'm going to go look at Uncle Ted stuff. Don't. Go look at monster trucks. They're awesome. I love them. Gravedigger, cool stuff. He's green. I love it.
Wise words. Actually, I will second that. Going to a monster truck rally is quite an experience. I this is one time I will encourage people to actually do something, and that's going to a monster truck rally.
Yeah.
With that, thank you. That was Emmy. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for inviting me on. We always have fun here.
Of course.